Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Thanks for once again keeping KMUN on the air a while longer. I start today's program with a salute to the advent of American journalism 329 years ago this month. I wrote it. The First Freedom. The first newspaper published in the English American colonies, public occurrences, both foreign and domestic, printed by Richard Pierce and edited by Benjamin Harris, appeared on the streets of Boston on September 25th, 1690, but was soon suppressed because of unkind remarks about the British crown. 45 years later, in 1735, John Peter Zenger was put on trial and acquitted for defamation against the English king in his newspaper, the New York Weekly Journal, which raised issues of a free press that contributed directly to the First Amendment. He spent nearly a year in jail, however, before going to trial. 30 more years passed before Thomas Paine wrote Common Sense, which inflamed the American Revolution, and later Rights of Man, which was made the rationale of the French Revolution. 2 years after the Bastille was stormed in July 1789, the Bill of Rights, something almost an afterthought, tacked on to the American Constitution as its first 10 amendments, were adopted into law as the most basic rights of the common citizenry. The First Amendment guarantees the freedom of speech and a free press in the assumption that liberty survives only in an atmosphere of free and open expression of thought and opinion, no matter how diverse or uncomfortable. Controversy is the language of democracy, yet those who rule in the name of democracy continually attempt to limit the range of ideas and information necessary to engage in the arguments of opinion indispensable to political and personal freedom. The Romanian-born French playwright Eugene Ionesco once wrote about living in Romania in the 1930s when the fascists had come to power. Everything was saturated with fascist promotion: radio, movies, newspapers, posters, and billboards. It was, he wrote, impossible to not be worn down by its ingestion of the culture. The United States is in a similar position 80 years later in the teenaged third millennium. In a real sense, the 1950s, a period of political hysteria and repression in the USA, are being essentially completed after nearly three-quarter century interruption, with many eruptive tremors in the interim. We are in a cycle described by Henry Adams and Arthur Schlesinger the Elder as one of private interest, a result of disillusionment and drained energy that follows a vigorous and chaotic period of public activism, an inevitable recoil as people become tired, confused, and angry at the demands upon their intelligence, compassion, patience, and pockets. In this instance, a reverberating, lurching perpendicularity of political mayhem. The problems of responding to the needs and demands of increasingly larger segments of disenfranchised segments of people and ideas frequently provoke retrodoxical eagerness for simplified solutions to sociopathic intransigence. This is when, as the late Rolf Brown from the now extinct Independent Republic of Cannon Beach, which flourished briefly during the 1970s, sagaciously quipped that distressed citizens begin looking for, quote, the jackass on the white swine, or vice versa, who spouts cant simplified into dogma, or vice versa, and stale prejudices that fault subgroups for all that has gone wrong, vulgarizing them as the other to be rid of as a pestilence. The cultural dialogue narrows considerably. Complex social and political questions are reduced to an us or them snarl. The most clamorously ignorant demand that their vengeful fables be legislated into political truthiness and rigorously righteous social cleansing. In the names of freedom and justice, both are perfidiously eroded. Like Ionesco's Romania, it becomes exceedingly difficult to resist the inversion that permeates the social viscera. Censorship of opinion and expression are not recent malignancies. They have plagued humanity since the primordial swamp. The tendency of authority, whether tribal or governmental, is to rule, and it is a parasite. It must, by the very nature of implied power, feed upon and subtract the political rights and liberties of those it rules. The bedrock assumption of political and personal freedom is that the average human being is intelligent and fair-minded, inspired by compassion and justice, and that most people will think and act reasonably most of the time. Our historical predecessors reflected this assumption when they self-named our species Homo sapiens, from sapient, dictionary defined as having or showing great wisdom or sound judgment. That presumptive theory is in general conflict with the assumption of omnipotent governance that the common citizenry is doltishly unintelligent, primitive, and brutal, and must be shielded from its own precarious nature, which seems to suggest that governmental sapiens are markedly restrictive in their sapien definition. Freedom and authoritarian dominance are quite obviously in dialectical conflict. In order to dominate beyond its presumed authority, a government must subjugate any opinion, campaign, or crusade that challenges the arbitrary views or purposes of those in power. Yet in terms of democracy, a government of the people is assumed to also be a government for the people, which in turn makes it imperative for the people to be protected from predatory or cruel government. To remain free, or to at least hold on to what might remain of political independence whenever governing authorities abrogate their constitutional restraints, the unfettered flow of information and ideas is necessary. The problem is that it is almost sacred dogma that an informed citizenry would act reasonably and with sound judgment. The reality seems to be that the vast bulk of information on nearly every conceivable and esoteric subject from everywhere in the world, at all times of day and night, every day and night, and the sheer volume of its variety, statistics, facts, opinions, ideas, as well as reportage, and 360-degree points of view of each and every imaginable occurrence, activity, or possibly newsworthy event or spectacle, is incomprehensible. At some point, the beleaguered brain overloads and shuts off. Apathy among the multitudes is not accidental or the result of not having access to information. It is most usually the opposite, a premeditated response to a world awash in pixels, paper, and verbiage. We opt out. We do not want to know. We know too much. It is this which confounds the believers of information as the temple of freedom. To cull through the immensities of banal drivel to discover what is pertinent, or work through the purposely misleading, might finally be too much to require of a citizen. Suppression, after all, fires the wronged spirit. Gluttony buries it. The basic idea of communication in the vast centralized societies is, as described in an essay in Manus, to profit from the weaknesses and reflexes of the masses and to stimulate the movement of goods. Rarely is any sort of education or awakening provided. A workable definition must be made of information and what purposes it serves, whether it is a public dialogue and serves as a necessary function of an open society, or whether it should be privately controlled to reflect only certain ideas and points of view. The First Amendment answers unequivocally. Congress, which makes law, shall make no law that abridges freedom of speech or press, or for that matter, the increasingly problematic internet that is astounding for its depths of prejudice and depravity, not to mention its criminal violations of privacy and fake truths. And that's in quotes, truths. The First Amendment also protects the right of people to peacefully assemble and dissent, nor can the right of free religion or none be tampered with. It is, in addition, the right to not speak or right to refuse to communicate. And it is also the right of access. It is not enough to have freedom to speak if all of the effective media of communication are unavailable, either as a result of government action or non-action on the part of private interests that control the media. And it is the right to know, the right to not have government keep secrets from us, although that is, unfortunately, what government does perpetually. The purpose of the press, or media in its multiplicity, is little understood in actual fact, which is as much the fault of itself as it is the result of public unconsciousness. The people expect event and spectacle, which are ardently provided in scandalously commercial abundance by the media. But the main, foremost, and vitally essential function and purpose of the journalistic media in all its hydraic forms and appendages is to act as the prickly conscience of power and authority, the critical watchdog, the cry of alarm when authority is exceeded or corrupt. Journalism, the fourth estate of society, although the lowest rank of status, acts as intermediary between the upper two registers of piety and patrician, and the third estate of the people, thus the term media. It is also the fifth horse rider of the apocalypse, the scribe busily cataloging the horrors perpetrated by the other four. No one should ever be surprised that a government does not encourage liberty or independent opinion among its subjects and or citizenry. Democracies are, after all, elaborate power balances between ruled and rulers that are intrinsically fragile despite constitutional law. A critically important assumption of a democracy is that the flow of information should not be tampered with nor be restricted. But of course, interfering with and manipulating information is among the basic priorities of political power, which accurately assumes the general populace will not give much thought to mind control efforts most of the time. We should remember George Orwell. He invented a language, newspeak, which was based on erasing unwanted ideas in the pretense of simplifying the public dialogue. He warned that what is removed from language is forgotten in the individual and collective mind, arbitrarily replaced by an alternate reality. Orwell was wrong, though, when he suggested that a propaganda system depended upon violent coercion. Instead, in a post-Orwellian world, we suffer the benign control of a powerful apparatus of indoctrination and propaganda that needs little coercion to set an agenda for people to think about. Amnesia and distortion of a free press have continually given rise to small newspapers and magazines and to independent radio and television stations whose only allegiance is to the First Amendment, and not unlike third political parties that incubate ideas that the major parties often eventually adopt, the independent miniature media provides a vital forum for the exchange, analysis, understanding, and argument of issues that are at the base of every culture and society. The goals of this jousting journalism are debated in all human habitats everywhere on Earth: to develop, expand, and improve liberty and justice for all, to communicate truth free of deceit and distortion, which must be like a rock or a star, a fact defined by its existence, and to assist in the eradication of sexism, racism, poverty, and war. These are the true horse riders of death, the dooms and glooms, the perversities and horrors of our busy, ill-tempered species. And as epilogue, from the first moment of his presidency, Donald Trump demanded that his lies were truth and that the media in America were purveyors of fake news and declared the enemy of the people. Trump is a compulsive liar who seems to define truth as only what benefits and adulates him. He considers the First Amendment a permissive and unnecessary impediment to be ignored and ultimately abolished, despite or because of its being the foundation of American freedom of thought and speech, including freedom of dissent and of religion, as well as freedom from religion. He has recently established a commission of unalienable rights to determine, in his judgment, which rights are entitled to gain respect. And that's a quote. He also chaired a truthiness consortium in the White House, attended by a host of non-credible crackpots, lunatics, rabid right-wing Morlocks, and white supremacists he fulsomely praised as true American media heroes. Unfortunately, the mainstream media seems obsessed with Trump, an obsession that greatly assisted his rise to the presidency and ultimately fulfills his personal obsession of always being on stage, always in front of the camera, as though no one or anything else in the world counts. And now, I suppose many of you are aware that Laura Snyder has died. Those of you who did not know her personally might have heard her on KMUN hosting folk and women's music, or are familiar with her work for the Clatsop County Women's Crisis Service, which has rebranded itself as The Harbor. Those of you who were fortunate to know her most likely frequented her Joy of a Bookstore over the years, or associated with her during her many years on the Astoria School Board, or at the KMUN Radio House, or through the Crisis Service when she was its Community Service Coordinator. Were you aware she spent 5 years as ship's cook aboard sailboats, twice crossing the Atlantic Ocean, once to Russia? She told me once she named her bookstore Lucy's because that was going to be the name of a daughter who was instead born a son. She wrote an article for the Times Eagle 25 years ago, A Right to Be Safe, which resounds more than ever now, which I am now going to read in anticipation of October being Domestic Violence Awareness Month and in tribute to Laura. A Right to Be Safe. By Laura Snyder. I have permission to go to the store. He smashed my head into the radiator until it bled. He tied me up and twisted me like a pretzel. I'm pregnant, and he threw me down on the floor. This is not the script for a made-for-TV movie, nor is it a sensational portrayal of the myth of violence in the home. These and countless other stories were all told to me during my work days at the Women's Crisis Service. In your neighborhood, someone is beaten on a regular basis by her intimate partner. Maybe you've heard those muffled shouts, maybe even called the police. In your neighborhood, a child is being sexually abused. A quarter of the women in your workplace were raped as adults or as children. If you are a school teacher, you are working with children who live with violence. Did you know? Police officers in Astoria estimate that 60% of reported simple, meaning misdemeanor, assaults here are domestic in nature. In Clatsop County, the rate of known child abuse is double the state average, and per capita alcohol consumption is second only to Lincoln County. The Oregon Criminal Justice Council reports that the county with the highest total reported crime rate was Clatsop. Clatsop also ranked number one in behavioral crimes and ranked above the state average in person crimes. Domestic and sexual assault and abuse account for most person crimes in Clatsop County. People most commonly ask why women stay in abusive relationships. They stay out of fear. Most women who are killed by their partners are killed in the process of leaving the relationship. Economic dependence, having nowhere to move to, and the inability to act on their behalves, and low self-esteem that are one reason of being battered repeatedly. People most rarely ask why men batter, intimidate, and in 1,500 instances per year in the United States, kill the women they claim to love. Myth: women's behavior provokes beatings. Fact: no one can make another human being hurt them. Most people blame the victim of battering for the crime, sometimes without realizing it. They expect the woman to stop the violence and analyze her motivations for not leaving, rather than scrutinizing why the batterer keeps beating her and why the community allows it. Until responsibility for acts of violence is placed on the perpetrators, we all suffer. Battering is a learned behavior. Children who are witnesses to violence often grow up to be abusive to their partners and children. 85% of men who batter were abused or witnessed assaults on their mothers. Somewhere along the line, batterers have learned that violence is a way to gain power and maintain control over their intimate partners and children. And somehow, our culture has taught itself that power and control is an end. Depressing? Yes. But there is hope for change, and it comes with the establishment of a coordinated community response which has succeeded in San Diego, Minneapolis, the state of Kentucky, and an increasing number of locales where service providers are determined to stem the tide of family violence and mandate the accountability of abusers. Task forces, including domestic and sexual violence victims advocates, law enforcement, and prosecutors, created policies and procedures that would deter further abuse, decrease the number of repeat calls to the same address, and that would not re-victimize the victims of domestic violence. This work has successfully changed the focus in domestic violence cases from the victim to the abuser by replacing the age-old question, why does she stay, with how can we stop him from hitting her? The domestic violence unit of the city attorney's office in San Diego has become expert in prosecuting domestic assault cases without involvement from the victim, who is often intimidated, threatened, or scared by her abuser out of cooperating with police and prosecutors. Prosecutors obtain over 2,000 convictions per year without the victim's testimony. The Domestic Violence Unit of the San Diego Police Department has implemented a pro-arrest policy mandating long-term treatment for batterers or substantial jail time, with priority placed on the safety of the victims and their children. If it took a lifetime to learn the use of violence to control another person, it will not be undone with a fine or a few years in jail. Officers and detectives on this unit are trained extensively in the dynamics of domestic violence and confront their own assumptions, biases, and privileges, which might hinder their effectiveness in the field. In 1 year, preliminary violence reports from police increased by 60%. There is great potential here in Clatsop County to create effective policy that works while fostering trust and partnership among committed people in all facets of service to victims and their children. It is time to move forward as a community. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Take time to think about your own neighborhood, your own workplace. The epidemic of family violence raging across the United States is happening in your own backyard. Tell a friend or a neighbor in an abusive situation that she has a right to be safe. Find out how to help her become safe. Demand accountability for abusers. Get involved. Be aware from this October forward. And that was A Right to Be Safe by Laura Snyder, who, when she wrote this, was community service coordinator for the Clatsop County Women's Crisis Service, which is now called The Harbor. And she wrote this article in 1994. At the time, she was proprietor of Lucy's Books in Astoria. And now, my very old friend, he's a month older than I am, Walt Curtis, Oregon's perennially unofficial poet laureate, the Harvest Moon. Every year in autumn, as I drive in the country with the golden leaves falling and the crops ripening in the fields and the grass yellow and the crickets chirping incessantly, I am reminded of death and the cycle of the seasons. The swollen harvest moon is like the skull of a murdered child. The bones are laid bare by the withering of the years. Such a moon cries out for justice, but more than that, for an understanding of mortality. The one thing which is certain about death is that it is completely open as to what happens. All we can say is that death is a departure from life. It is the only absolute. Everything else that we do in life or get involved with, we have a certain amount of control over or input into. Not so with death. It has to be accepted and acquiesced to. Perhaps the harder one struggles against it, the worse the experience of dying may be. Everyone has to do it eventually. The smartest and the dumbest, the ugliest and the best looking, popes and atheists, capitalists and criminals, John Birchers and bisexuals. When he was alive, my father called death the great equalizer. So what happens when you die? No one knows for certain. As a poet growing up in rural Oregon, I would like to offer some speculations. Allow me to wax poetic, if you will, even nearly incoherently so. I enjoy nature very much. Trees, rivers, mountains, open spaces. I am certain that nature is infinite. In any city, I often feel trapped, enclosed in an abstract, man-made world, which is finite. I feel that with my senses instinctively, as a dog or a deer would. In nature, there is infinite variety, change, form, color, shape, force. You can go as far as a distant nebula or to the bottom of the Pacific Ocean. We are never going to measure love technologically. We are never going to stop death with our machinery. Attempting these things is an insane and unnatural activity. The intellect breaks down, the spirit liberates itself, and the body takes care of itself in corruption and finds repose. The corpse turns into earth and rain, flowers, and possibly new living flesh. Driving back after having dinner with my mother on the anniversary of my father's death, a profound idea popped into my head. One never gets away from nature, not in these words on paper, nor inside the comfortable cloth and metal of the automobile. The breeze blows in the windows of the car. I am breathing the breeze and adding to it. That brings me to the main point of this melancholy discussion. We must trust nature. Death is okay. Death is going to be all right when it comes in its own due time, in terms of the natural scheme of things. It would be a mistake not to die, not to leave the old forms behind. Even if that were possible, it would be a delusion of the rational mind. A civilization which attempts to escape death is making a terrible cosmic mistake. To try to escape might be to destroy life. And I think, in actuality, this is precisely what is happening. Technocrats and materialists, mechanist scientists, and bureaucrats are making life unbearable. Love canal, radiation from nuclear power, lead contaminants in mother's milk, PCBs in the ocean. The new technological industrial processes are disrupting and poisoning the delicate ecology of this fragile green biosphere which we call Earth. With gene splicing and bionic medicine, these same scientists are trying to create an immortal new man, which will be part zombie and part robot, a pathetic, meaningless creature. We must die so that life itself can be reborn. I do not mean that particularly in a Christian sense, though the Christians and the Buddhists have the sense of it. You might become a purple rhododendron or a robin. A baby born in 2050 AD could be using your life force that your meat scraps lost when you died. Where was that force being stored, or what was your soul doing? Do you think I know what I am speculating about? see that is what happens when you talk about or think about death. You cannot logically pin it down until you do it. And then maybe you won't know unless or if you become conscious again. Trust your intuitive spiritual feelings. Death is going to be the easiest thing you ever do. It might even be fun in a cosmic sense. Start life over. How disappointing. I have enough respect for my life, how I have loved and lived, and whom I have been with and shared the miracle with, in its finality and one-timeness, that I accept my death and total oblivion. Transcendental humanity is less than flesh and blood humanity. Now counts. The earth counts. This ball of clay I consecrate with my spirit, as you must with yours. When I look up at the horrifying harvest moon, yes, I feel sad, but I also treasure the existential beauty of it. We only live once, and each moment of our life is unique and special, as is every human being we meet. Revel in the wonder of being before it is given back to the void. And that was by Walt Curtis, The Harvest Moon. And as he claims to be a poet, I would like to read one of his poems, Ni Akani Moon. White pearly moon, observant as an eye, shine on bone white snags. Disgraceful race decimates great Douglas fir. Sunset is salmon pink to sea. Slaughtered fish runs. O Kani, God witness of a thousand generations, remove scavengers from the scabbed land. Primitive Pacific coast, scarred by their deprivations. May they and their seed die out, lead depleted lives. O most beautiful place on earth, rainy Eden of dewy jade-like trees and Taoist rocks. Ocean fog leaves a kiss on wounded landscape. Indian God, forgive us our trespasses, as we cannot those who pass this way trespassing against primordial beauty. May this race die off, and their offspring slew into the ocean, scraps of maggoty meat for wheeling gulls and pounding wave smash. Pitiless moon, see all. Be a searchlight for natural justice, reflecting pearl, bone, and polished shell. And that was Ni Akani Moon by Walt Curtis. And this is Michael McCusker.